Good morning. You're listening to Praxis on KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. I'm your host, Taylor, and this morning I'll be talking about all kinds of things, really, inspired by seeing a winter blockbuster you may have heard of, The Wolf of Wall Street. It wasn't the best film of all time. I'm not going to like belabor talking about the film or analyzing the film because I'm sure you can find all kinds of that everywhere. And, you know, I don't really do movie reviews, but sometimes I have in the past and I will today use a film as a jumping off point because I really do like films. I really like art in general. And I think that's a good way that we can examine all the crazy stuff that's going on in the world. And there's no shortage of crazy stuff going on right now. So, that being said, I went yesterday to the matinee to see Wolf of Wall Street with my dear sister. We didn't realize it was 3 hours long. I kind of expected to spend less of a sunny day inside, but it ended up okay. And I couldn't really decide right away how I felt about the film. You know, I liked it. I can't decide if it was overly excessive or not. I'm really curious to see how people who aren't me react to it. And I'm just going to start off with, I don't want to offer any spoilers for anyone who may still want to see it, you know, any of that. But there is a pretty good review that I found, and I may just use that as a jumping off point and then kind of get into this idea of greed. And is greed an addiction? And what is addiction all about? What's the psychology of, you know, wanting more and more, and the psychology of getting rich quick, and all of these things that kind of pervade and characterize American culture. If you're a fan of the show on Facebook, you saw the John Steinbeck quote that I shared that was actually jogged in my memory. It's one I'd heard before in this review. Matt Zoller cites this. It's on RogerEbert.com. He reviews with Roger Ebert, apparently. And the quote is, pulling up right now, "Socialism never took root in America because the poor see themselves not as an exploited proletariat, but as temporarily embarrassed millionaires." And yeah, that's John Steinbeck talking about the U.S. And apparently that's the way he saw it a while back, you know, early in the 20th century. And that's definitely how a lot of people are today. I caught myself in the coffee shop when I was preparing this show talking to a friend of mine about his record collection and how, you know, he couldn't afford certain records. And I said, well, someday you'll have money for that. And there's no, you know, I just said that. It's just in my speech for some reason. And I kind of caught myself and thought that was a little funny. You know, I had to tell him afterwards, you know, you probably won't ever get rich. And, you know, you might just never buy that record. And maybe that's okay. So we're going to talk about all of that today. So I'm just going to start off with this review. And I'll interrupt it, as I tend to do, as you know, if you're a regular listener to the show. And pepper in some of my own thoughts. So Matt Zoller cites... Seats. Sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name, Matt. If by some strange chance you're listening to this. He says, "Martin Scorsese's The Wolf of Wall Street is abashed and shameless, exciting and exhausting, disgusting and illuminating. It's one of the most entertaining films ever made about loathsome men. Its star Leonardo DiCaprio has compared it to the story of the Roman Emperor Caligula, and he's not far off the mark. Adapted by screenwriter Terrence Winter from the memoir by stockbroker Jordan Belfort, who oozed his way into a fortune in the 80s and 90s, this is an excessive film about excess, and a movie about appetites whose own appetite for compulsive pleasures seems bottomless. It runs 3 hours and was reportedly cut down from 4 by Scorsese's regular editor, Thelma Schoonmaker. It's a testament to Scorsese and Winter and their collaborators that one could imagine watching these cackling swine for 5 hours or 10 while still finding them fascinating and our own fascination with them disturbing. This is a reptilian brain movie. Every frame has scales." That's definitely. Then he talks a little bit about the plot, which what you need to know, you know, whether or not you're going to see it. Basically, it's this guy, Jordan Belfort, who's a real person and who actually appears in the movie, which is part of my concern with it, with this kind of blurring of the line of satire or not, at a pretty dangerous time when not very many people understand that satire is a thing. He was middle class, Queens raised. He got a job at one of the big, he was a stockbroker at one of the big, which firm was he with? It doesn't matter. But he got laid off in the market crash of 1987. Then he discovers penny stocks and he starts basically ripping off middle class and poor people instead of richer people, and figures out how to rebrand this scheme that he's running with penny stocks in a larger arena with a lot of success. He ends up being investigated by the FBI for fraud and all of the things that he's involved in, which are very sketchy, and serving some minimal jail time and being fined. And it's apparently he still hasn't paid the fine today, and now he's out in the world and he has a he's a motivational speaker for companies. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. So that's my, I should have just read it because he was more efficient with that summary than I was. But so it, in typical Martin Scorsese style, if you're a film person, it's shot like a gangster movie. And really, I mean, these people basically are gangsters. They're figuring out how to be the best, you know, white collar criminals they can be. And yeah, I have some, I'm not going to read this whole review. I just realized how long it is, but I'm going to pull it. I'm going to start back down here. So continuing with the review. As is often the case in Scorsese's films, Wolfe gives alpha male posturing the attraction-repulsion treatment, serving up the drugging and whoring and getting over as both spectacle and cautionary tale. In his most exuberant performance since Titanic, DiCaprio plays Belfort as a pipsqueak Mussolini of the trading floor, a swaggering jock who pumps his guys up by calling them killers and warriors, and attracts hungry, self-destructive women, partly via brashness and baby-faced good looks, but mostly by flashing green. The film lacks the mild distancing that Scorsese brought to Goodfellas and Casino. My speech today. The former contrasted Henry Hill's matter-of-fact narration with occasionally shocked reactions to bloodshed. Casino adopted a Stanley Kubrick-like chilly detachment as if everyone involved were narrating from a cloud in heaven or a pit in hell. Wolfe is in the thick of things at all times, to suffocating effect, depriving the viewer of moral anchors. This is not the same thing as saying that the film is immoral, though. It's not. It's disgusted by this story and these people and finds them grotesque, often filming them from distorted angles or in static wide shots that make them seem like well-dressed animals in lushly decorated terrariums. You can tell how much Belfort cares about his people by the way his narration segues from an anecdote about a broker who fell into a spiral of misery and shame. He says, he got depressed and killed himself 3 years later, Belfort says, over a photo of a corpse in a bathtub trailing blood from slit wrists. Then, without missing a beat, he says, anyway. These images of censure and humiliation, and there are a lot of them. Some of this is not radio appropriate, I'm realizing. So he's talking about how there's a lot of graphic scenes involving prostitution, involving drug use, involving just general debauchery, which is just part of this culture and part of how Belfort, this character, kind of bonds with the people he's training, you know, his killers, to be the best stockbrokers possible and, you know, to be the best salespeople possible, and really shows that his theory is really tied up in this idea of, you know, dehumanizing others and winning at any cost. And it works in that. Matt continues, we're supposed to figure out how we feel about the mix of modes and accept that if there were no appeal whatsoever to this kind of behavior, no one would indulge in it. This isn't wishy-washy, it's honest. Scorsese and Winter never lose track of the bigger picture. In theory, the movie's subject is the Wall Street mentality, which is just a clean-scrubbed version of the gangster mentality showcased in Scorsese's Mean Streets, Goodfellas, and Casino. Wolfe starts with a Fellini-like party on the floor of Belfort's firm, then freeze frames on Belfort tossing a dwarf at a huge Velcro target, literally and figuratively abusing the little guy. The traitors get away with their abuse because most people don't see themselves as little guys, but as little guys who might someday become the big guy doing the tossing. Socialism never took root in America, John Steinbeck wrote, because the poor see themselves not as an exploited proletariat, but as temporarily embarrassed millionaires. Belfort chides the prosecutor Coleman for living what Henry Hall would have called the goody-two-shoes life, and in a scene near the end, as Coleman rides the subway home, we can see that taunt stuck in his craw. Everyone at Belfort's firm seems to have the title senior vice president. Everybody wants to rule the world. But the film's vision goes beyond cultural anthropology and anti-hero worship. When people ask me what the film is about, I tell them that like a good many films by Scorsese, who overcame a cocaine problem in the early 80s, at its root, it's about addiction, a disease or condition that seizes hold of one's emotions and imagination and makes it hard to picture any life but the one you're already in. Many people get a contact high from following the exploits of entrepreneurs, financiers, bankers, CEO, and the like, and when such men, they're nearly always men, get busted for skirting or breaking laws, they root for them as if they were disreputable folk heroes, gangsters with fountain pens instead of guns, guys who, for all their selfishness and cruelty, are above the petty rules that constrict the rest of us. Such men are addicts, egged on by a cheering section of little guys who fantasize of being big. We enable them by reveling in their exploits or not paying close enough attention to their misdeeds, much less demanding reform of the laws they bend or ignore. Laws that might have teeth if we hadn't allowed guys like Belfort and his far more powerful role models to legally bribe the United States legislative branch via the nonsensical system of campaign financing. After a certain number of decades, we should ask if the nonstop enabling of addicts like Belfort doesn't mean that, in some sense, their enablers are addicted too, that they, we, are part of a perpetual motion wheel that just keeps turning and turning. In the end, Wolf is not so much about one addict as it is about America's addiction to capitalist excess and the he who dies with the most toys wins mindset, which has proved as durable as the image of the snarling gangster taking what he likes when he feels like taking it. Scorsese and Winter aren't shy about drawing connections between Belfort's crew and the thugs in Scorsese's mob pictures. Those mob films are addiction stories, too. Wolf of Wall Street showcases Belfort Henry Hill style as if he were an addict touring the wreckage of his life in order to confess and seek forgiveness. But like a lot of addicts, as Belfort recounts the disasters he narrowly escaped, the lies he told, and the lives he ruined, you can feel the buzz in his voice and the adrenaline burning in his veins. You can tell he misses his old life of big deals and money laundering and decadent parties, just as Hill missed busting heads, jacking trucks, and doing enough cocaine to make Scarface's head explode. There will be a few points during Wolf when you think, these people are revolting. Why am I tolerating this, much less getting a vicarious thrill from it? At these moments, think about what the it refers to. It's not just these characters and this setting and this particular story. It's the world we live in. Men like Belfort represent us, even as they're robbing us blind. They're America, and on some level, we must be okay with them representing America. Otherwise, we would have seen reforms in the late 80s or 90s or aughts that make it harder for men like Belfort to amass a fortune, or that at least quickly detected and harshly punished their sins. Belfort was never punished on a level befitting the magnitude of pain he inflicted. According to federal prosecutors, he failed to abide by the terms of his 2003 restitution agreement. He's a motivational speaker now, and if you read interviews with him or his memoir, it's obvious that he's not really sorry about anything but getting caught. We laugh at the movie, but guys like Belfort will never stop laughing at us. So that's Matt Zoller-Seitz's review of Wolf of Wall Street. And wow, it's longer than I thought it was. So overall, there's things I disagree with, such as, you know, the problem being that campaign finance ruined the ability of the U.S. citizenry to flex their supposed muscle over Wall Street. I don't think that's really ever... I mean, there were once tighter banking laws, but the market's more or less always been in control for as long as the U.S. has existed. So that's kind of a little, you know, point of contention. But, you know, overall, I like that he brings up that it's more a film. It's more about a value system rather than about an individual who just, you know, likes to party and is like a cult leader and gets other people on his bandwagon. It's an entire value system that people, the part I enjoyed about the film was that it shows people who aren't part of that system, really, really like vying to become part of it and really believing, like in that Steinbeck quote, that they're just temporarily humiliated millionaires and that, you know, soon enough they'll get theirs too, because that's the American dream. And that really explains a lot of the behavior of folks in this culture. So in the comments under that review, there's a couple other points that I think will probably come up a lot. I haven't been reading a lot of like news about this, but apparently there's been pieces on people walking out. I didn't see anyone walk out when I went to see it, but because it's, you know, it's pornographic and excessive, it definitely probably borders on both of those. But, you know, that's part of the point. The I think personally as a woman, and I skipped part of the review where he talks about the main character's first wife being a good woman and the second being kind of a gold digger, whatever. It's you know, the film doesn't do a great job of portraying the women as characters, but I think that's part of the point. I doubt that this person, when writing his memoir, considered a lot of the women involved to be characters in the true sense of having their own motivations and, you know, minds and things like that. So I think the kind of, personally, I think that the excess and the overwhelming, you know, imagery and the overwhelming naked women everywhere all the time is kind of part of showing how, you know, desensitized this culture is, represented by this group of people, to other people's humanity. You know, just other people aren't as real as you are if you have an entire world kind of built up around you. So that is so then the other issue that people are arguing about in the comments, and that I was arguing about in my mind with myself, and I'd love to discuss with anyone else who sees it and wants to chat. I mean, I think my consideration of the movie, mostly because I like Martin Scorsese and Leonardo DiCaprio, I kind of want it to be true, thinking that it's flat out satire, you know. And there's definitely moments in the film where there's like a big slow motion nod, like this is satire to people who are watching it. But then, you know, and it's kind of a cautionary tale. It's kind of like a parable about excess and about greed and all of this. But then at the end of the film, when Leonardo DiCaprio as Jordan Belfort is making his return, you know, as a motivational speaker, and there's all these people in the crowd just eagerly awaiting his wisdom, waiting to hear how he basically defrauded people to get rich. And they want to learn how to do that too, how to take advantage of people most effectively, basically. You know, after he's already been indicted and gone to prison, people still are showing up for his motivational workshops, just hungry for this knowledge. And so you'd think that that's a good ending for the film because it's satire. But then I found online that the person who introduces the character is the real man, is the real Jordan Belfort. And including him in the movie kind of seems like a big red flag, because how can it be satire? You know, the guy's not satirizing himself unless this has been some huge like postmodernist meta project of his to like do this entire his entire life as a commentary on the culture. I doubt that that's true. It'd be pretty fascinating and thorough if it was true, but you know, including him in the movie after using his memoir, which he didn't write as satire, he wrote it as a memoir, using that as the foundation for the script almost word for word, and then including him in the film seems really, really strange. So I'm curious to see what's up with that. But enough on the specific film. I asked folks on Facebook, I only have one response so far, but continue to respond if you'd like. I asked, why do you think some people always want more? Is greed part of human nature? Answer so far, people starving while having ads with delicious looking food everywhere. When they get that food, they go crazy. And I think that's part of the explanation for, you know, the so-called little guy, as the person writing the review said, if you have a system that is based in inequality, and you never have anything, maybe it is more tempting to grab all of it when you can. But I don't know if that's always true. And I don't know if this person's being sarcastic at all or not. They can call if you want. If you'd also like to call in, the number is 747-3807. And sorry, I'm moving the phone so I can see it in case someone calls. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about the psychology of greed. It's all things I would have guessed, but I like to not just guess and go to people who have devoted some part of their life to studying this. So this is a pretty short article called Greed, the Ultimate Addiction. And I'm going to follow it up with another paper that I like better by the same psychologist, Leon Seltzer. He's a clinical psychologist and author of Paradoxical Strategies in Psychotherapy. And this is from October 2012. And the paper is called Greed, the Ultimate Addiction. He says, what connects the various addictions is that enough is never enough, not for long anyway. As addicts progress, or rather regress, into their addiction, to derive sufficient gratification, they must constantly seek more and more of their drug of choice. For more is the key word of addiction. It doesn't matter whether they're addicted to a substance, relationship, or activity. The ante for getting enough of the object of their craving must continually be raised. But of all the things one might be addicted to, nothing tops the greed-laden pursuit of wealth in its audacity, manipulativeness, and gross insensitivity to the needs and feelings of others. Not to mention its extreme, short-sighted, irresponsible covetousness. Ask a multimillionaire or billionaire so afflicted, if you can find one willing to talk to you, and you'll discover that their mega fortune quest really has no endpoint. They won't be able to name the definitive millionth or billionth that finally will do it for them. They can't, because the means by which they reap their riches has itself become the end. Chasing every financial opportunity, and it cannot be overemphasized, to the detriment of virtually everything else in their life, has become their be-all and end-all. For that, frankly, is where the dopamine is, the master molecule of pleasure and motivation. And the end for them is simply the high or dopamine release they receive each time they do a deal, turn a profit, or make a killing. And just like other addicts, over time, because of the related phenomena of tolerance and dependency, they'll need to make bigger and bigger killings to get the ego gratification they require in order to feel good about themselves. In general, their money high has to do not just with feelings of fiscal elation, but with a kind of self-inoculation. What perpetual wealth production inoculates them against are underlying and barely recognized feelings of distress, such as depression, anxiety, guilt, or shame, which stem from a belief that deep, deep down they may not be good enough at all. So greater and greater financial success is required to help them sustain their cherished illusion that they really are superior, in economic terms vastly superior, to others. A most convenient narcissistic fix for whatever subterranean doubts they may yet harbor about themselves. On an ethical level, the worst thing about their pursuits is that their mercenary, ego-driven achievements frequently do considerable damage to others and their prospects. Not always, but typically, those who might be called greed addicts aren't in the professions of creative arts, but in business. Entrepreneurs, investors, speculators, lenders, CEOs. And most often, their successes contribute little or nothing to society. Rather, their undertakings are cunningly contrived to transfer money out of the pockets of others and into their own. Exceedingly competitive and aggressive, they'll take ruthless advantage of every opportunity to turn a profit and not shy away from turning against others in the process. To them, luxuries, for example, my Ferrari, my yacht, my estate, my penthouse, are necessities. They all make them look good, and appearances are one of their foremost considerations. For material acquisitions can wondrously mask woeful deficits in their core self-image. Still, it should be stressed that whatever appetite they may have for things, their interminable lust for making money doesn't really have that much to do with tangible purchases. Contrasted with spending addicts, a compulsion that drives such over-the-top consumers or shopaholics into unmanageable debt, greed or wealth addicts are hardly focused on depleting or dispersing their fortune, but on acquiring and maintaining it. Unconsciously linking their fundamental human value to their financial worth, what drives their behavior is accumulating as much wealth as possible, and then using it to acquire still more wealth. And this is why they're apt to become suicidal should they experience a severe economic reversal, for it feels as though they've been stripped of all personal value. It's been said that you never get enough of what you don't really want. With people addicted to pursuing wealth, their overwhelming, insatiable passion isn't about getting rich, but richer, and still richer. And it's unquestionable that this is not a virtuous cycle, but a markedly vicious one. Ultimately, their heart's desire, tragically unknown to them, isn't for wealth at all, but for love, emotional intimacy, unconditional acceptance and self-acceptance, and rich, satisfying relationships. Regardless of how obscenely wealthy they may become, these are all things that, alas, cannot be purchased with money. The final debacle of their pursuit isn't simply that their monetary accomplishments can't ever bring them the lasting happiness and peace of mind that they secretly crave. It's that their futile quest generally causes all sorts of misfortune to others, as well as to our environment, which they blithely ignore, and to our nation, whose misregulated capitalistic system regrettably supports their ceaseless, avaricious ventures. So that's the first of these two articles by Leon Seltzer that I'm going to share. And I should preface all of this with the idea that I have a real problem with characterizing things like greed as addictions, because it's, I think there's been a trend within psychology and within kind of like pop psychology, especially of making a lot of behaviors into more clinically specific problems than they really are, you know, being able to lump a lot of different things into addiction, you know, having each compulsive behavior have its own category as a problem that can be treated with medication, or, you know, rather than looking at what he gets to at the end of this article, getting to what do people actually need. And that's something important. And it's something that isn't asked in our culture. And that's a lot of why people try to fill this thing they don't understand with stuff that they just think might fit. You know, it's not a very scientific process and not a very fulfilling one for folks. So I think characterizing it as an addiction is dangerous because it takes the control out of the person's hands. You know, it's that, oh, well, I can't do anything about it because I'm just addicted to making more money, and you know, you should feel bad for me. It's like, well, you know, I feel bad that there's a culture like this that facilitates these kind of developments in people or defects in people. But at the same time, there's a personal responsibility issue that I think gets lost in the shuffle when we characterize everything as addiction or as neurosis. That's a choice, you know, to some large degree. So this is the second article that's related to that that I like better. He wrote this earlier in 2011. Again, this is also Leon Seltzer, and I'll include all these links in my podcast description for folks who want to check it out. This is what he says about the pursuit of happiness or the quest for wealth. Sadly, in our capitalistic culture today, the two aspirations denoted in the above title, to me sharply contrasting, are frequently confused. They can be and have been viewed as virtually identical. And if in fact happiness is conceived in monetary terms, then the money gained, the more material objects acquired, the closer you are to reaching this most enviable of goals, right? Hardly. As ironic as it may seem, materialistically pursuing happiness is doomed to fail. It's a goal that can never be achieved. As will be explained shortly, almost by definition, it's not even reachable ever. On the other hand, if happiness is understood from a more spiritual perspective, it's potentially well within your grasp. By spiritual, I'm envisioning this ideal state as emanating from a variety of non-materialistic attainments, which would include a fulfilling sense of belonging or community with others and all of nature, the development of warm, supportive, mutually self-disclosing relationships, an unconditional love, respect, and acceptance of self, one that's totally independent of environmental circumstances, and an almost unassailable state of well-being, having little to do with personal health and even less with material abundance. Once you experience contentment, not complacence, with your lot in life, neither financial assets nor physical robustness are pivotal to such well-being. Your peace of mind, your overarching satisfaction with your existence, despite its inevitable ups and downs, is secured. So the calmness and cheer of what's going on inside your head, for example, the buoyancy of your thoughts and feelings, far eclipse the turmoil, the gloom and doom that may be taking place outside. And in your general acceptance of life, you gain ultimate control over it. This is what I was getting at, and I'm glad he mentions. However much you might wish to see positive changes in the world, to bear witness to the betterment of humankind and society, you also accept that your ability to influence external events is limited. You do what you can, but you don't anguish over the current state of affairs or about the unalterable framework of mortal existence. What is good enough for you. Moreover, happiness as an enduring state of mind is, at least potentially, available at any time. It doesn't need to be pursued, as, say, a luxury sports car, a bracelet from Tiffany's, or tickets to the Super Bowl. It's nothing that requires questing after, since once you've come to wholly embrace yourself and the world around you, it already exists safely inside you. In fully espousing the world, with all its inequities, injustices, and suffering, your happiness is removed from harm's way. Achieving such a state of acceptance or being is really the ultimate gift to yourself. And again, it's not anything that requires being hunted down from the outside, then somehow assimilated from within. On the contrary, chasing happiness through the acquisition of wealth, through amassing more and more things, is a fool's pursuit. For once such material appetites are aroused, at a certain point they become insatiable. Substituted for longer-term satisfactions, the pleasures and gratifications they yield are more or less fleeting. In addition, no amount of money can suffice when sooner or later fortune-seeking itself has become obsessive. When that critical line is crossed, the pursuit is no longer a means to some presumably fulfilling end. It is the end. And once, paradoxically, the goal has become the pursuit of the goal, you're left in the self-defeating position of hunting down that which can never be captured. Like an unquenchable thirst, not the riches, but the lust for riches can never be satisfied. Materialistically searching for happiness through accumulating wealth invariably cries out for more of the same. The incessant seeking for what can never be definitively achieved explains why so many millionaires, and especially billionaires, can be so aggressive, so merciless in their ongoing exploits to accrue more wealth. Addictively chasing incalculable riches, a fortune going far beyond the dreams of avarice, as though such a radical pursuit must somehow vindicate their self-interested cause, they end up monomaniacal, megalomaniacal, inhuman, and to say the least, inhumane. Their bullheaded endeavors become ever more competitive, mercenary, ruthless, and mean-spirited. Consider, for example, the billionaire Koch brothers and their latest underhanded but unmitigated efforts at busting unions, which stand in the way of their amassing yet even greater profits. Just as addicts typically require increasingly more of their drug of choice to get high, those who are already wealthy need even greater wealth to feel, employing a phrase I regard as crucial, good enough. And because, as the philosopher Eric Hoffer put it, you can never get enough of what you don't really want, the key to lasting happiness is never accessible to them. Having worked professionally with several multimillionaire malcontents, I can say that what they really craved were those things intrinsic to happiness laid out at the beginning of this post. The transient highs that accompanied their wealth accumulation were never much more than a hormonal rush anyway. And even though, in the eyes of the world, they were enormously successful, continuing frustrations and insecurities gave testimony to the fact that the blast of feel-good chemicals their success yielded was all too easily exhausted. Money can't buy harmonious, fulfilling relationships with others, and it certainly doesn't have the power to generate unconditional acceptance of self. For such an internal embrace bears little connection to your bank account. In fact, your monetary wealth, so far from securing the single most important relationship in your life, ends up making it all the more conditional. As long as you measure your self-worth in dollars and cents, it must rise or fall in accordance with the success or failure of your latest enterprise. Moreover, people with extreme wealth tend to be tight-fisted, almost miserly. Statistics repeatedly show that the very rich donate disproportionately less to charitable organizations than do members of the middle class. And how could this be otherwise when contributing substantial sums of money to worthy causes cannot but be experienced by them as reducing their personal worth, which they've learned to appraise financially? However unconsciously, actually giving money away is precarious to their self-image. At last, compulsive efforts to somehow purchase happiness is akin to reaching out toward a greased object that, even if momentarily snatched, is downright impossible to hold on to. Similarly, worshipping the false god of mammon enslaves you to objects of desire that can never be held fast. Even when they do appear caught, they offer only temporary highs, never happiness. Still, seduced by what our society typically defines as success, watch enough TV commercials and you'll get an acute sense of how success is portrayed in the media, it's easy enough to lose your way and zealously embark on a path incapable of providing any real sustenance. So obsessively questing after wealth and all that it can buy ultimately sows the seeds of later frustration and disappointment. If your appetite for riches or a super luxurious lifestyle is now threatening to become addictive, you may wish to reconsider whether pursuing such affluence is really a worthy goal. Remember, inevitably you have to come down from what frankly may be a terrific high. But if instead you devote yourself to becoming high on life, or rather, give up getting high for truly getting happy, a far more lasting state of well-being may await you. That last part sounds a bit like a fortune cookie, but I still like it. So basically, that was also, I forget how quickly I read in my mind, and then when I actually speak things, they're really long. But basically, you know, money can't buy you love, or whatever those folks said. And I find that an interesting, I don't hear a lot of psychologists or folks who study psychology or just people in general talking about that idea that, I mean, you kind of hear these phrases that have become trite, like money can't buy love, money can't buy happiness. But, and yet, you know, people still destroy their health, destroy their well-being, destroy their relationships in the pursuit of money. As a proxy for survival and growth and this idea of eventually having enough. And I really like that quote. I want to say Eric Hoffer was the philosopher's name, the you can never get enough of what you don't actually want. And that's something good to meditate on in the new year and think about. And this whole... What a big problem that I was really excited to find an article about that I've noticed. I think that the way this culture studies itself is bizarre. It's not, unless you get into the higher realms of academia, it's not really detached from itself. And so we end up behaving as though, you know, America is ancient and that our systems are these long enduring systems that are as real as gravity. You know, they are immovable, they are permanent, that capitalism simply is the greatest system ever conceived, and that, you know, why would we change? There's just some little flaws. There's just some little tweaking that we have to do. And the idea that the whole premise is flawed is just not something that we talk about. And in some ways, you know, studying these fields, studying the establishment, the status quo in psychology, in sociology, in many other fields like that, it preserves these hierarchical structures we have. For example, this is the article I found that made me really happy. It didn't make me happy, but it made me vindicated in my belief. Does Studying Economics Breed Greed by Adam Grant. In 1776, Adam Smith famously wrote, "It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we can expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest." Economists have run with this insight for hundreds of years, and some experts think they've run a bit too far. Robert Frank, an economist at Cornell, believes that his profession is squashing cooperation and generosity, and he believes he has the evidence to prove it. Consider these data points. In the U.S., economics professors gave less money to charity than professors in other fields, including history, philosophy, education, psychology, sociology, anthropology, literature, physics, chemistry, and biology. More than twice as many economics professors gave $0 than professors from other fields. And while giving to charity isn't necessarily the best strategy, it's an indicator of people's probably well-placed desire to help in a vague way. More deception for personal gain. Economics students in Germany were more likely than students from other majors to recommend an overpriced plumber when they were paid to do it. Economics majors and students who had taken at least 3 economics courses were more likely than their peers to rate greed as generally good, correct, moral, or natural. Less concern for fairness. Students were given $10 and had to make a proposal about how to divide the money with a peer. If the peer accepted, they had a deal. but if the peer declined, both sides got nothing. On average, economics students proposed to keep 13% more money for themselves than students from other majors. In another experiment, students received money and could either keep it or donate it to the common pool, where it would be multiplied and divided equally between all participants. On average, students contributed 49% of their money, but economics students contributed only 20%. When asked what a fair contribution was, the non-economists were clear. 100% of them said half or more. A full 25% said all. The economists struggled with this question. Over a third of them refused to answer it or gave unintelligible responses. The researchers wrote that the meaning of fairness was somewhat alien for this group. And that's, you know, that the actual idea of economics is just about wise distribution of resources. You know, that's all an economy really is. It's like an ecosystem. It's a management of what's available for the best possible outcome. And that's obviously not what we study, but there's all of these interesting mind tricks and all of this cognitive dissonance that you have to endure reading the basic modern economics textbook. You have to believe in all kinds of strange superstition, the invisible hand. You know, Adam Smith opening this article is pretty fitting. So this article continues. But maybe studying economics doesn't change people. It could be self-selection. Students who already believe in self-interest are drawn to economics. There's evidence for selection. In a study of over 28,000 students in Switzerland, 62% of economics students gave money at least once to help students in need, compared with 69% of non-economics students. These differences were already present before the students took a single course. Students with lower giving rates were drawn to economics. As freshmen, before their first lectures, 71% of the students who chose economics contributed, compared with 75% of non-economists. That's not super compelling numbers-wise to me, but still interesting. And here is more of that evidence. I'm just going to kind of blast through. At the very beginning of their freshman year, Israeli college students who planned to study economics rated helpfulness, honesty, loyalty, and responsibility as just as important as students who were studying communications, political science, and sociology. But third-year economics students rated these values as significantly less important than the first-year counterparts. When faced with choices between cooperating and defecting, overall 60% of economics majors defected, compared with only 39% of non-economics majors. Looking for the specific one. Oh, this is an interesting one that I'd like to read more about but didn't have time for. Just thinking about economics can make us less caring. Exposure to economic words might be enough to inhibit compassion and concern for others, even among experienced executives. I would add especially rather than even, but we'll see. In one experiment, Andy Malinsky, Joshua Margolis, and I recruited presidents, CEOs, partners, VPs, directors, and managers who supervised an average of 140 employees. We randomly assigned them to unscramble 30 sentences with either neutral phrases like green tree was a, or economic words like continues economy growing our. Then, the executives wrote letters conveying bad news to an employee who was transferred to an undesirable city and disciplining a highly competent employee for being late to meetings because she lacked a car. Independent coders rated their letters for compassion. Executives who unscrambled sentences with economic words expressed significantly less compassion. There were two factors at play, empathy and unprofessionalism. After thinking about economics, executives felt less empathy. And even when they did empathize, they worried that expressing concern and offering help would be inappropriate. So this whole kind of theme of, you know, a market needs goods and commodities. And that's something that what I'm about to play will cover probably more eloquently than I will. And people's labor becomes commodified and those people become dehumanized. And if you're also in this spiral of, you know, self-loathing wealth accumulation that the first paper talked about, then you're probably quite likely to viciously dehumanize others in your quest for more. And if there are a significant group of people, even if it's only, you know, 1% of the total population who are doing this, the stakes are bound to be continuously raised as long as people are trapped in this weird mind spiral. So, fortunately, there are alternatives to these types of systems. Fortunately, human development really plays toward cooperation. That's what we do. That's what, you know, that's what we really crave, as the psychologist pointed out, and as anyone who takes a moment to just sit quietly and think about it knows. You know, what we want is connection with others. We want acceptance. We want freedom to do whatever it is we want to do. And that comes in all kinds of variations, because that's what's fascinating about humans. So that's good. And people are starting to realize this. And in a variety of ways, both kind of integrated within the system we have now and, you know, on the more extreme, just completely defying it and leaving it behind, people are expressing that in other ways. So I'm going to play this short talk. Shane Hughes, who calls himself a reconomist, not a term I'm crazy about, but it's his term, so I'll use it. And he talks about a collaborative economy and what that means. So I'm just going to play this for you and then pop back on for some closing thoughts. If you're just joining me, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS, Bin Air Community Radio. You can find the podcast at kyrs.org or at praxisradio509.podomatic.com. Here is Shane Hughes.
Thank you. Okay, I've taken on a really easy task today. I thought I'd make life easy for myself, and I'm going to try and talk to you about a possible alternative to our current economic model. And I must be either crazy or utopian, but I'm certainly not an economist, which makes this slightly more difficult. But I'm actually an environmentalist, and I'm an entrepreneur, and I'm a little bit of a dreamer. And I work for an organization, and over time we've realized we can't solve the major environmental issues unless we start to fundamentally change our economy. So this is why we started down this road. And we've started to realize also that we're not alone. If you go to Spain, for example, or if you go to Greece, of course you're going to find people there who reject the current economic system. But it's not just in those countries that are feeling the difficulties of our time. Also in Germany, for different reasons, the people are skeptical of our current economic system. And this report that just came out in Germany also talks about Brazil and China and this growing skepticism with our current economic model. So we get to this point where we say, okay, there's a problem, and now what? So as well as growing skepticism, there's also growing kind of innovations, growing new models. And I want to talk to you about that side of the coin today. And I'm going to use Lou Brown and her project to introduce to you some of the things that I think are features of a new and emerging kind of economic model. Now, Lou Brown saw in her neighborhood there was lots of gardens that were overgrown. People weren't looking after their gardens because they were ill or too old or too busy. And she knew people that needed access to land. So she created this matchmaking service, and it was popular, people loved it. Before you knew it, it grew. It changed into a website called Landshare. And before you knew it, we've got 70,000 people registered sharing their land. And the features that Lou's project have as an integral part of a project, and are also an integral part of this new economy that we're seeing, is this idea of networks. The idea of access rather than ownership, the idea of sharing, the idea of collaboration. So this idea of collaboration isn't anything new. Already within the economy, there's the cooperative movement, and it's an integral part of our economy. We just don't really notice it. It's not a very apparent part of our economy. In the US alone, there's 30,000 cooperatives delivering food, energy, water, and around the world, there are now more people working for cooperatives than there are working for multinationals. So it's an integral part of our current economic DNA. And I'd just like to say it's like a sleeping giant, and it's slowly awakening. 2012 was the UN's United Nations Year of the Cooperative. And as part of that year, There were lots of events with the cooperative organizations getting to know each other and kind of awakening to their own potential. An example of just, there's lots of ways that cooperatives are different from traditional kind of corporate entities, but one example is the Mondragon Cooperative in the Basque region of Spain. And one of the things we see with cooperatives is just how resilient they can be to shocks like economic downturns. So this example shows the area where the Mondragon Cooperative is. It's actually a set of 200 cooperative enterprises. That area has considerably less unemployment than the rest of the country. Okay, now cooperatives, they've been around for 170 years. They are not going to create a new economic model. What we need for a new economic model is something that makes the old model obsolete. So I'm going to introduce to you the information economy. Now, you've probably heard many, many times that we're now in the information economy. But what does that mean to our economics? I'm going to try and introduce that to you. So in the beginning, we had hunter and gatherer economics. The two main components are tribes and land. We shift our economy completely to an agricultural system where the new components are land plus labor, and then the kind of organizational structures are tribes and institutions. Now, these institutions are things like empires, governments, corporations. Then we have a new revolution, a completely new economic system, and we have the new kind of economic input is capital. And it's not that land and labor disappear, it's just that capital becomes the overarching, most powerful economic element in the kind of mixture. And our new organizational component becomes the international markets. So finally, we're sitting on this cusp between these two worlds, the old industrial economy and the new information economy. And that's why we're seeing these kind of certain disruptions going on. Now, the new components that the information economy bring to us are information, of course, that's the economic component, and we're seeing the organizational components as networks. And what I want to try and do to you now is introduce a few places where we're already seeing the information economy disrupting and making obsolete the industrial economy. And the most apparent place where we have the information economy is of course, online. And open source technologies is something that we see online. Collaborative consumption and also peer-to-peer technologies are the two or three things that I'm going to talk about now. So one thing we notice in the information economy, sharing adds value. In the industrial economy, scarcity is what added value. So these are completely different principles. They don't coexist perfectly. So a good example of a disruption is the famous example of Wikipedia. Within a very few amount of years, the old industry of the encyclopedia industry, which was built on proprietary ownership models, was disintegrated. Another example of disruption in the old economy, hoteliers. The hotel group, Hilton Group, took 100 years to reach a point of its size. It's now the biggest hotel group in the world. Airbnb has a completely different format. They don't have hotels. They just provide access to people who have spare rooms, spare castles, or spare houses. And you can just connect with them directly. You don't need to have that kind of central infrastructure. And what's very interesting about Airbnb is it's a mixture of the old economy and the new economy. So you have hierarchies. Within Airbnb, the organization itself has management and hierarchies and all these other things. But they use networks as their core tool of accessing the markets. And so this is the interesting thing. One economy doesn't necessarily mean the complete annihilation of the old economy. It's those companies that know how to use best the mix of the old and the new that will be the most successful. Another example of disruption is peer-to-peer finance. Now, in the UK, Zopa is an example of a peer-to-peer finance organization. It just matches people who have money with people who need to borrow money. And recently, the Bank of England, one of the directors, said that he believed this peer-to-peer financing models could challenge the current financial institutions. So we're seeing this kind of another area of disruption. An amazing area of disruption is Linux and Windows. What we've seen is Windows in year 2000 had 97% of the market share. Now, we're using tablets and smartphones and things, and Linux, which is the basis of Android, is the most popular computing software in the UK and the US, and it's taking up a huge portion of the marketplace. So we're seeing this kind of disruption all over the marketplace. And what we're also seeing is this core theme that no longer is it survival of the fittest, me against you. It's right now is the people or the companies that can collaborate best are far stronger than those that can't. So all of this is all well and good. Great, let's imagine there's going to be a new economy. But unless it addresses the core issues of climate change and peak oil and resource depletion, for me personally, it's of no use to us. So this is the area that I have most interested in, and I work for an organization called Transition Network, and I work specifically on a project that kind of tries to understand the emergence of this new economy. The Transition Network is essentially a network of 2,000 community groups all across the world. And I try to support community groups in setting up new kinds of enterprises that use different ways of relating to each other economically. So very much in this idea of trying to compete with, to deal with climate change, we see people setting up community shops. There's about 200 of these community shops. Again, using these kind of collaborative processes, we see people setting up community currencies. Where I live in the UK, one of the community currencies that was set up, the mayor of Bristol, a city with 500,000 people, the mayor of Bristol is now taking all of his salary in this community currency, the Bristol pound. We see these kind of community farms where you use a model called community-supported agriculture. And it's a great model where the people who are buying the products also take a risk. They share the risk and the produce. So if there's a drought, everybody's in it together, as it were. And this CSA model, there's 8,000 of these in the USA. Lots of people are using their spare financial resources to invest in solar panels with a return on investment. Again, community models. So, and this is an interesting one. Instead of buying a bus ticket everywhere you go, you can have a membership to a bus kind of community, and then you just jump on and off whenever you want to. So this is a really interesting thing, but what I want to try and say is, I talked about three different movements. One is the cooperative movement, quite an old movement. One is this innovational kind of collaborative movement online. And one is this, what I call the change maker movement. And each of these provide integral ingredients to a possible new alternative. Without one or the other, there is no credible alternative. The cooperative movement provide hundreds of years of experience, of credibility, of size. They're huge. The collaborative movement provides that disruptive innovation that means that the old economy becomes obsolete. And finally, the changemaker movement provides that kind of ethical, deep-rooted solutions providing motivation. So I think collectively, these provide us with a credible alternative to our current economic model.
So that was Shane Hughes from Transition Network talking about just a few different types of potential ingredients in economies. I don't necessarily agree with everything he says, as is true with everyone I feature on this show, because that would be boring. But, you know, the point being that humans are, this has been a gradual process that's taken us away from more simple economic models. And it's not, you know, it's not that humans are greedy and therefore we went crazy and devoured the entire planet. There was some going crazy that happened, and there's some continual immersion in that. But the fact is that we can stop. You know, you can choose to stop, and, you know, we can, as a culture, shift to something a little more sane, or a lot more sane, hopefully, and a lot more positive for everyone involved, because that's where the happiness is, as that psychologist shared with us. I have one more response to my, what is greed part of human nature? Ravens like shiny things and like to collect them too. As my friend said, there's no reason liking shiny things has to result in oppression. That's an interesting spin on it. So thanks for listening. My time is just about up. And yeah, I'm looking forward to the next year of this show and what is to come. So Yeah. Hope you'll be around to listen to it and tune in every Monday morning at 10. You're listening to KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.